Okay.
It is on? Okay. Okay, so we kind of got this set stuff we start with, and when Steve comes in, we'll go back there so that he's clear. But I'm Steve Sanderford from the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Today's date is September the 21st. The time is approximately 1:45 Eastern Standard Time. I'm accompanied by various members of the FCIC. We're at the offices of the FDIC for the interviews of George French and Steve Fritz. Mr. French, could I get your verbal consent on the record for the recording?
You have my consent.
Thank you. What we'll do is go around the table, stating your name, and if you would spell your last name. Some last names are harder to hear on the tape than others. I'll start. I'm Steve Sanderford. I'm on detail to the FCIC from the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond.
Okay.
I'm Alexis Simmendinger. I'm part of the FCIC writing team.
John Thomas, THOMAS, Deputy General Counsel, FCIC.
George French, FRENCH, Deputy Director for Policy, Division of Supervision and Consumer Protection, the FDIC.
Steve Fritz. Steve, we have to my right, Randall Dodd.
Steve, how are you?
Steve Sanford.
How are you? Hi, Alexis. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, Steve Fritz, Associate Director. And we had just gotten started, Steve, so good timing. Thank you.
Steve, can we go back and pick up one housekeeping detail? The interview will be recorded. Could I get your verbal consent on the record for recording the interview?
Hugo and I had discussed this and before you came in, and he agreed that yeah. we could.
Did we get a copy of the recording?
No, but it's subject to the confidentiality agreement that the FCIC has, so it would.
So the answer was no, is that what I heard?
No, I can send you the audio file.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
Hugo will give you his card, and I'll email it to you.
CD or MP3, you can put it on your iPod.
Yeah, okay, that'd be great, thanks.
Good.
Just in case there's any question.
Oh.
Yeah.
No, that's fine.
I'll just prepare.
Okay.
So we were going around the table. I think, Steve, you introduced yourself, and George, I think, did we get to you as well?
Yes.
Yeah, and it's Hugo Zia, Supervisory Council, Legal Division.
Okay. Very quickly, in the way of background, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, FCIC, was established by statute, signed into law by the President. It's a bipartisan committee and consists of 10 commissioners. The FCIC is charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and collapse or near collapse of major domestic financial institutions. The commission is charged with writing a report of findings to the President and Congress by December 15, 2010. In addition, in my view, I believe a critical aspect of the commission's work is these interviews with experts who were involved, such as yourself. Our goal here today is to gain a better understanding of how FDIC examiners conducted their work in large institutions, particularly related to complex capital transactions. So with that, that's kind of the standard stuff. What we generally do as well is kind of go over backgrounds that you have, and I think back to this, but it's since kind of college, your educational background and then coming forward through the agency.
Okay, I have a PhD in economics from Northwestern University, and I taught as an assistant professor of economics at Tulane University for 4 years and then came to the FDIC in 1986. And I've been in the research division most of that time, or first 10 years actually, and then the Division of Insurance and then the Division of Supervision starting in 2002.
Good. Steve?
Well, I've worked for the FDIC for 34 years, almost 34 years, and I am a commissioned bank examiner. And I've worked in a number of locations around the country in a number of managerial positions, I'd be happy to provide my biography to you instead of going
through on it. I mean, mainly just the relevant pieces, but the Commission Bank Examiner kind of encompasses a lot of that, I think.
I think so, yeah.
How many years, just summarize, how many years doing bank examining, what would you say?
Well,
About
24 of it in bank examination work. For about 10 years of it, I was in the bank resolution arena.
Okay. And what your education?
I have a bachelor's degree.
Okay. From? Do you want to brag about your school?
Not really.
Well, we'll ask you for your CV.
Okay.
So kind of setting out, you know, the questions, and George, you're focused on capital policy.
Capital policy, yep.
And Steve, as we kind of got a background, your examination issues, including subprime guidance and mortgage.
Yeah, I've done a lot of different things over the years, including sweep the floors.
I know
so,
how you feel.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, I've covered about every arena in supervision, and both from casework and policy.
Well, we're focused, I think primarily on the capital piece, but it has elements. You know, there were elements that, certainly involved the examination side. You know, like the subprime guidance. So, as we kind of go through some questions, I think, just chime right in.
If you want to start with more of the subprime, you're welcome to. If it's going to be mostly capital, I hate for Steve to have to. It's up to you, Steve. But if you want, we can.
Yeah, I mean, do you have separate sets of questions for the two topics, or are they interwoven?
We can sure try to do that.
Yeah, I mean, whatever you need, whatever you already have planned is okay with me.
Fine. Yeah.
I think from kind of the on the ground view. The agencies have various guidance that's been issued over the years. I think maybe start talking about one, real estate lending guidance. I think we initially issued in 1993 a set of standards. They were updated later. These define high loan-to-value mortgages and put a capital constraint against those for retail. You know, it shouldn't exceed 100% of Tier 1 capital.
Well, those weren't limits. Those were basically a trigger point for reporting to the board of directors. So those weren't hard caps by any means. Those were triggering points for reporting to the institution's board of directors and keeping track of it for us as regulators to review.
How prevalent was that? Were these in specialized shops or, for the FDIC banks? Was this a regular part of exams?
Sure. The exams that we would look at that, sure. We as a matter of practice, read the minutes of every bank's board of directors meeting. So that's where we would report. And as a matter of sort of standard practice, we would look to see separately how many loans they were reporting that exceeded those thresholds. We, of course, would look at underwriting standards of the institutions as well as crack files on a sampling basis of loans to see that they were following their policies and practices and regulatory requirements.
Often when you do that, you find stuff you've never seen, new things. Was that the case over there?
Well, let's a couple of things. In the residential arena, our guidance and our policies and practices, if you look at it, are more portfolio-driven and classifications. And reviews are done more from top down. It's in the larger loan, the non-homogeneous loan, the non-consumer loans, and the commercial area where It's more looked at one by one. For example, the interagency classification and review standards for consumer credit, which includes residential mortgages, are driven by performance.
Where examiners, I guess I need to give you a time frame, say around the 2000 to 2004 time frame, involved with, were there trends that came into play in these exams for FDIC?
Yeah. Well, I'd say one, help me here, define me what you're asking about. If you're talking about subprime residential mortgages, is that the subject matter that you're talking about, or are you talking about something more broadly, or I'm trying to understand? I mean, we examine banks one at a time, okay? Yep. And our examinations are risk-focused around that each particular institution, applying the policies of the subject matter that fits that specific organization.
Yeah.
The reality is we issued a lot of guidance in the late 90s and about credit cards, consumer on subprime. The reality was the great majority of the banks that we examined, the community banks, if they did subprime, they didn't do it as a program. It was more, they would have a customer where they would make a loan, and it was strictly the definition of subprime, which is, one or more of those characteristics. Are you familiar with the definition? There really isn't a defined subprime borrower.
Right.
I guess the bottom line there is very few of our banks, of the thousands of banks we supervise, very, very few were engaged in subprime programs. You follow me that targeted?
Yes.
There were a few credit card companies that we supervised that targeted subprime customers. But by and large, and quite honestly, most of the banks that we supervised did not engage in residential mortgage originations, except some would do it on a, they were just originating it to distribute. But I would say most community banks are primarily, have been and continue to be, and maybe more extensively so, are engaged in small business lending.
Right.
The reality is it's very difficult for community banks to compete with the big banks because it's a scale-driven business on the consumer side.
Were there larger originators within the FDIC's supervisory? Were you involved with exams in larger mortgage originators?
Well, I really can't speak to that personally. The right person, I think, to talk to there is John Corston, wouldn't you say? I mean, I think we would have been involved in the exams of the large banks, the big 19, if you will.
Right.
We typically had some level of participation in those exams, but it wouldn't have been, we would normally have, I would say, I hate to say this without verifying it with him, because that's not really my area, but we would have some limited involvement.
Okay.
But, their exams, we examine community banks primarily point in time, typically once a year. For the exams of the big banks, those tend to be more continuous, and they do targeted reviews during different periods of the year. You follow me? It's a different concept.
What about the industrial loan company instead of the large bank holding companies or broker dealers? Same thing?
I would say, based on my knowledge, a lot of those were concentrated in the ILCs were in Utah. There are a few other, we did coordinated exams on the ILCs and would look. Most of those were wholesale companies. And of course, they had the, and I'm having the limitations on their, both their funding. They could only do, I'm trying to remember what they can do on the funding side. They couldn't take transaction accounts, I don't think.
They couldn't interest on business accounts.
Yeah.
They could do pretty much what a commercial bank.
On the asset side, they tended to be very, you know, trade driven, you know, whatever the trade finance was for their industry, if it was automobile manufacturing, Volvo, they did automobile. Target, I know, did essentially the business credit card business for Target. Mm-hmm. They tended to be very specialized, narrow product lines on the asset side.
Right, but some of the financial firms also had them. I was just curious, in those instances, how did you, if, for example, Lehman had ILC, how did you were, in that sense, the exclusive federal financial sort of banking depository institution regulator.
Yeah.
So how did you work with the SEC or whoever else to supervise, examine that bank? And what could you do about also its affiliates, if anything?
Well, you have the legal limitations on affiliate transactions. Our examinations, as far as the coordination with the SEC, the part of the function of our exams is we're the board of directors for the legal entity of the bank. I mean, that's one thing that we focused on. The board of directors of the or is the of that company, of the banking company, is responsible. And of course, one thing we look at is interaction with affiliates, parents, and we expect absolute and total loyalty for that board of directors to be to that entity. That's why I know in Utah, the ILC, they required a majority of their board members in each ILC to be local.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, the reality was there was a lot of intersecting, and it's not atypical for large holding companies to do a lot of stuff at the holding company, but we carefully review to make sure those actions or whatever is, you know, if they're doing some work for the sub bank, that those things are done on an arm's length basis.
So what level of cooperation did you maintain with the SEC, if it was a non-bank, or with the Federal Reserve Banks or OCC, if it was...
Well, the ILCs weren't, they didn't have holding companies. So you're talking about the affiliate companies that would be supervised by the SEC, right?
In the case of broker-dealers, that would be.
Yeah.
With American Express, I'm not sure if... how they it's not a broker deal. I don't know if there is a federal regulator for American Express.
Good question.
There is now.
There is now.
It's a bank holding company, but
right. They all most of those firms form bank holding companies when the crisis started.
Yeah.
Or in the midst of it.
There's an FDIC bank, I think.
The American Express has, I think, a FDIC insured ILC, and so. So you weren't able to look into its holding company structure, even as a non-bank holding company, and you couldn't look into its affiliates.
Well,
let me jump in. I mean, the FDIC as insurer has the statutory authority to examine the parent company affiliates to the extent that we think it is necessary to determine the relationship between the entity and the bank, and so if we think we need to pursue an issue, we can do it. And my perspective, I think I'm saying the same thing as Steve, is that in those kinds of situations, I mean, our focus was to protect the insured entity. That's our legal mandate, and we were pretty rigorous about that. My understanding, for example, the Conseco insurance company declared bankruptcy. They had a legal entity that was an insured depository institution, industrial bank. We walled that off. They did not fail. I don't believe, you better check the facts, or one of us better check the facts. I don't think the Lehman Brothers ILC ever failed. I mean, we were focused, the SEC was focused on the broker-dealer, we were focused on the bank. If we felt we had needed to take actions to wall off the ILC and Lehman Brothers, and I suspect that we probably did, we were able to accomplish that. So I think you're raising questions about the comprehensive and consolidated supervision, and, you know, it's all one big family and that sort of thing. And I think our focus at that time was certainly on the insured depository.
You had some authority, though, to look into the parent and the affiliates.
To ascertain the relationship. And
That's the wording. It's not hot pursuit, but then to ascertain the nature of the relationship or transaction.
Well, I think it's important to understand that, as George said, we're focused on that insured entity and depositors. And the upshot is we recognize that control shareholders, whether it be a parent company or the local businessman who owns a majority of the community bank stock, they have an opportunity to influence decision-making in that bank. That's why we hold the board of directors accountable, absolutely, for the what goes on there. And that's why we also look very closely, and there are regulatory prohibitions and or high standards for any interrelated activities by controlling interests. So there's a lot of levers and things to look at, but they're very focused on that entity. Just as even with bank holding companies, we look very closely at make sure that the interrelationships there are on an arm's length. To the benefit of the bank basis.
I don't have first-hand knowledge of this, but my understanding would be that when, for example, if a activity of the industrial bank is outsourced to the holding company, or to the parent company, more correctly, let's say there would be a Utah ILC, and then some important functions would be performed in New York, technically at the parent level, that as part of the bank examination for the Utah bank, we would have examiners go to New York and meet with the people they need to talk to, get the information they need. So it's technically it's part of the bank examination, but it is touching on the activities of the parent that are performed on behalf of that bank.
Mm-hmm. And that would include risk management?
I couldn't say which exact activities in particular would be outsource, but
the answer to that, it could be anything. Okay, it could be any services. In fact, it's fairly common for those ILCs to have dual employees.
Yep.
But I would just say this: our focal point ultimately is the accountability of that bank's board of directors. So they who establish all the policies that the bank employees have to follow, they're the ones accountable. They're also the ones we're going to sue if the bank fails and they were deficient in meeting their fiduciary responsibilities.
And I guess the thinking is that if you can, at the bank solvent, and you understand the relationships with the parent and affiliates, then you can be assured that problems with the parent or the affiliates are unlikely to cause material damage, safety and soundness threats to the legal entity, the ILC.
It's just like, hey, you can have large borrowers that are put the bank at risk. We don't go and examine the large borrowers. We look at how the bank manages the credit exposure of that large borrower. And, of course, we expect the bank to get sufficient information from that borrower to be able to properly evaluate that risk. and where there's some kind of insider relationship with that creditor, we look very closely, more closely. And, of course, there are very specific standards there for Rego and 23A and B relative to any credit extensions.
Maybe focus a little bit some of the activities in the large banks, and you know, I guess BB&T comes to mind. You know, pretty large mortgage originator, or pretty large piece of their business. You know, maybe talk about some of this guidance as it came out and the activities that the examiners might have conducted.
Well, I couldn't answer that without going back. And look, I would just say this. I wouldn't characterize, I mean, for us, probably BB&T is a big mortgage originator, but they're not a big mortgage originator. I mean, they're I don't know where they are on the scale of, you're talking about residential, they're not significant at all.
Yep.
They're a very small player. Really, if you look at BB&T, they're primarily a large regional, very focused on business lending, small and medium company business lending. I mean, if you went to a brokerage analyst, I think that's what they would tell you. I'd have to go and look and double check, but I don't think residential mortgage origination is. I'm not saying they don't do it. They do do it. But you know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, there are four or five companies that totally dominate the residential mortgage origination business. Right. And they're not one of them.
The FDIC has involvement, you know, with the largest companies with you know, special examiners on site. Somebody like Robert Burns comes to mind. What was their involvement? During what was their role during, say, the financial crisis? Was there any reporting that Robert Burns brought back to saying, oh, does he do regular reports?
You know, if you really want to pursue that specifically, I would recommend that you talk to the function within the FDIC that deals with that, and that's historically been part a separate branch within the Division of Supervision and Consumer Protection. Going forward, it'll be a different office, actually, separate from DSC. But, you know, we had a dedicated examiner in each of, you know, originally eight of the largest banks, and you know, they would report back to headquarters on, you know, what the issues they saw and that sort of thing. So, but if you really want to delve into it, I would recommend, I think you really do need to talk to
That's fair.
To them, and I apologize, wasn't prepared, you know, for that.
No.
Yeah. I think it's important to realize there's standard protocols for our large bank supervision program. If they meet certain size thresholds, they have, and certain thresholds, they have an exam. We have an examiner in place. Otherwise, if they meet certain size thresholds below that, we may not have an examiner there unless we're the primary federal regulator, but we do periodic reports, which are called Liddy reports.
Right.
So there's a standardized, you know, reporting. Typically, those are done semi-annual or quarterly, depending on different. I'm not an expert on that, but I mean, we have the people and can tell you all of that. Exactly how that's done. So there is standard reporting, and then there's ad hoc reporting.
I'm trying to get at information around the lending, and I've been in BB&T and looked at their mortgage operations, and so we're really focusing, I think, you know, more on some of this guidance that's come out and what the FDIC experience say is that you guys were working on an interagency. The non-traditional mortgage, what was your view? Apparently, one to that this isn't really a big deal for our FDIC banks. They're not really large, but I don't want to put.
Well, I think it was a big deal. Certainly was a big deal because we saw what was going on, more so in the non-bank than the bank sector. I mean, if you look at the non-traditional mortgages and the subprimes, almost all of that was in either the non-bank sector or the thrift sector. You know, most of the reality is most of the bulk, my observation is, and I can't quote you the statistic, the bulk of the residential lending done in FDIC-supervised institutions
right.
was done in the Northeast by the savings banks and thrifts that we supervise. That's where the who were in that business have been in that business for many, many years, who never bid any exotic products. I mean, it stuck very much to vanilla. Now, we had one or two that were out in California that did get in the exotic product business. Saw them not too successfully.
Can, the legal structure for FDIC-supervised savings banks and thrifts versus the OTS regulation.
Yeah, that's how just, well, that has to do with their chartering type.
Okay.
So we did most of the state savings banks and the mutual savings banks. Those are state chartered and not, they don't have the, it gets very complicated. And if you ask me the legal differentiation, most state chartered thrifts, well, when I say most, I don't know. Some are FDI supervised, some are not. Even with the new regulation, the new right. Dodd-Frank, there are going to be some that are coming to us because of their charter, their specific charter type. So I, but I do know this, up in the Northeast, in New England and Northeast, the great majority of those we supervise.
Okay.
And that's what the business they're primarily in.
You mean you're the primary federal
regulator.
You have supervisory authority, although maybe not the primary federal supervisor for all the FDIC insured institutions.
That, yes, backup authority, right.
So supervise most of these.
I was trying to get to yeah. was your question about where did we intersect with
right.
you know residential mortgage loan. That's where the bulk of the lending of where we are the primary federal supervisor was in is in the New England Northeast area.
Now, one of the banks that Steve mentioned is the Cup in California. I mean, obviously, yes. one was Fremont. And so when you say, at some point you said, so the FDIC just didn't think it was a big deal or something. I kind of putting words in your mouth, but that's
no,
kind of what I heard.
A lot of involvement we talked about.
And I think we certainly did think it was a big deal for some of those banks.
For some of those
and there was,
exactly.
I think we took a C&D in you know early 2007 and,
yes.
and that sort of thing. So you know when you say, oh, you didn't think it was a big deal, I don't think I would
yeah.
quite you know buy into that characterization. But I think along with everybody else, we certainly freely admit that we collectively, you know, wish we'd seen it coming a little more than we did for, you know, the subprime
and,
as a whole. But
and we were very engaged in the policy development on those
on
issues, even though most of our institutions didn't have those products.
But there was. Like
but we were aware of what it was going on in the marketplace.
Yep.
And, you know, there was cause for concern.
So help me if I characterize this incorrectly, but I mean, you had Fremont, some limited exposure in California in terms of the mortgages, and then you had a fairly large exposure in terms of number of banks
right.
In origination in the
in
Northeast.
In New England and Northeast.
Was
because that was their primary business,
that was
doing
primary.
Residential mortgage lending.
Yep. Yep.
Outside of that area, most of our community banks don't do that. I
That's
mean,
right.
they're primarily small business banks.
Yep. I mean, as, you know, problems started to, you see something in Fremont that's like, whoa, I didn't, you know, is there a communication process in the FDIC to, you know, relay to the guys in the Northeast that these guys in California are doing X or Y?
Of course. I mean, we have a regular National Risk Committee meetings, monthly or almost monthly, if not monthly. We've had that for some time. It's been several years, probably more than 5 years at least, going back to the early 2000s, I think.
Can you explain who attends?
Well, the division directors and their mm-hmm. chief senior staff in the business lines of deposit insurance, supervision, resolutions, selected people on the, you know, in the chairman's office or vice chairman's office, and the chief financial officer. So there would be presentations on different risk issues that people were seeing as they either in the field through the examination process or from the off-site monitoring perspective or from economists. In 1996, the FDIC started the Division of Insurance, which had regional economists, one in each regional office, and the responsibility was to interact with the exam staff and do sort of big picture economic trend analysis and try to make sure that the examiners had the economic trends they needed to be aware of, and that also the risks the examiners were seeing were communicated. So it's been a pretty self-consciously, a very concerted attempt for quite some time for the FDIC to be forward-looking and that sort of thing, try to get ahead of the trends and anticipate what they might be. So actually, I think our division of research at some point 4 years ago, 5 years ago, published an article that talked about how in the past we've never had, well, we've just had rolling regional recessions. We've never had a national real estate problem, but pointed out there was a number of synergies or sort of correlated developments that may have increased the likelihood of a national real estate downturn. So we've been attuned to these things, but like everybody else, the question is when do you step in, and is it warranted to sort of put the foot down on lending? And it's a tough balance to find, especially when everybody is making, you know, real estate prices are soaring and everybody's making money, and it's hard to be the lone person who says, wait a second, we got to put a stop to this. So that's always the challenge, I think, in supervision.
Yeah. I think back to your question, too. We're coming from two different frames of reference. You know, the reality is the institutions up in the Northeast, our institutions that we supervise and where we're dealing with supervisory issues, doing our job every day, they weren't doing this, but the examiners as well as the institutions sure were aware that lending was going on. I mean, the non-banks and even the thrifts, a lot of them had national footprints through loan production offices or brokerage networks, mortgage brokerage networks, and the thousands of mortgage brokers with nationwide footprints. They were competing against those in their market. The reality is, in some parts of the country, those exotic products never really took hold. And in New England and the Northeast, they never really did to a significant degree. And our institutions never tried to compete with that. Now, why? I don't know. You'd have to go talk to them. So they also read the newspapers, you know,
right,
our examiners and the bankers. So they were pretty aware of what was going on.
Remember, they didn't want to hold them and didn't know who to sell them off to. That's probably a different part of their secondary mortgage market than they're familiar with Fannie or Freddie or some of the more vanilla.
Well, that's one solution. One might say they went through a very rough time in the mid-80s and they decided, you know, maybe they're just going to be very careful. we could speculate a lot about that.
But your experience would be that they weren't originating like non-traditional mortgage.
That's right.
Products and then selling them.
Yeah, that's right. I'm speaking very generally. You know, was there one small? Could there have been one small savings bank in Needham, Massachusetts that originated a few? I don't know. Maybe they did, but was this ever an issue? No.
Right. And the non-traditional mortgage, the risk layering characteristics were a focus of the exam process. So
yes,
the examiners would have been looking at that.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And so far, these guys invested in mortgage-related securities. They didn't venture outside the agency MBS?
I wouldn't.
I can't answer that.
I wouldn't say that at all. We have great concern about, and have had for several years, about community banks buying, risky securities, based on a rating that was marketed to them, by an investment advisor or whatever. CDOs of TRUPS, trust preferred securities, private label mortgage backed securities. It's a weight on the back of the banking industry, including community banks, to have portfolios of that stuff. And it was a systemic problem in the sense that I believe that the way the system worked generated. It was very profitable for some people to just pump that stuff out and sell it, and everybody bought it, including community banks.
And that's somewhat new in a sense. I mean, they don't buy corporate bonds. They don't buy.
Well, in most states, they're prohibited from owning corporate bonds. There are only a relatively few states where banks can invest in corporate bonds. Most states, they're prohibited from investing. Typical, understand this, by state law and reserve requirements and regulatory liquidity requirements, they have to maintain a certain level of marketable liquid assets. And then typical state law limits what those can be invested in, and typically, and I'll tell you, each of the 50 states' laws is each uniquely different, and that's what rules in that state.
Right.
And typically it has to be in investment grade by the rating agencies, securities, and not equities, and some states allow for some corporate, but it's limited. Most do not, but each state law is a little bit differently. So typically they'll have treasuries, agencies, and mortgage backs. If you looked at the typical investment portfolio of a community commercial bank, they're not typically into real exotics, although we've had a few get into that, and quite often, much to their chagrin, later they get sold on a concept that.
Mm-hmm. And we're those rules are, if I could just interject to make sure I understand you properly, those rules are probably written at a time when the RMBS market were agency RMBS, and not there might not have been private label when those statutes were written.
That's probably right. And most of those state laws have been around for a long time.
Market environment.
Yeah, that's right. That's probably. I mean. You're making that assertion, I'm not, but I think it's probably about right. But, I mean, like I said, each state law is different, and they revise their laws on their own time frames and as a needed basis.
I don't want to anticipate the capital discussion, but when you ask that question about securities and why banks hold them, I mean, I think that naturally bleeds over into the agency's capital regulations, and we really, I think in retrospect, we opened the floodgates in 2001 or whatever it was when we did the recourse rule, which said 20% risk weight for investment AAA and AA, which kind of created, one might argue, created a market for a natural market for those securities and by banks, and so there was a lot of incentive to issue those and to get a good rating. Right. Using whatever model you had to model the cash flows. And
right, and I'm just an economist like yourself, so when I look at different rules and statutes, I tend to sort of, think about the rationality of why, mortgage-backed security is a necessarily a different credit risk for the point of view of the bank than a corporate. There are conflicts of interest you don't have with the mortgage-backed security.
But anyway, well, why one type of credit risk and not another?
Well, I'll give you my opinion, okay? And it traces back to the Depression, when a lot of banks were equity investors and corporate investors, and a lot of banks failed because of those investments.
Well, yeah, certainly equity is a lot riskier than an investment grade corporate bond.
Well,
so I can see that.
Not necessarily.
but also there's conflicts of interest you have there you don't have with the pooled money security.
All the old rules.
You don't have inside versus outside knowledge. As you as a buyer of a corporate bond, you may have inside information because you're a private lender to them. You'd have non-public information in which you could use to buy or not buy, or perhaps even make markets in corporate securities.
All the old
that was one of the distinctions between the two. You don't believe that?
I'm making a face because when you talk about private knowledge and that sort of thing, I certainly think of opaque CDO structures, and I don't believe that anyone. I'm sure that the information problems were just as severe there as they were in any corporate bond. I mean, but that's just my opinion.
I'm going to give you an anecdotal story.
It's a different conflict. I mean, in the sense that people didn't look into the structures very carefully on some of the more complicated structured credit products. But it's different than, you know, if I'm an underwriter for some corporate name or their bonds, I know, and I'm a lender to them, then I have. I can trade on non-public information. I'm not relying entirely on public disclosures to buy or not buy or to short a corporate name.
I thought there were similar issues with...
In some instances, I think with a more vanilla RMBS, there's not. You've got a pool, and it's supposed to be documented. The documents are supposed to be... I suppose if you actually the guy that put the pool together, you might have more... more knowledge than the people who didn't put the pool together. That's true.
Can I ask, since we talked about the 2001 residual rule, and your name is on the request for comments on a lot of these policy pieces. I mean, were you involved during the 2001 time frame?
You know, I came to supervision in 2002.
Okay.
And so I was not involved in the recourse rule.
Okay.
At least I don't remember. I mean, I was never involved before I came to supervision. So if that thing was published before summer of 2002, yeah. I wasn't involved.
Yeah.
But yeah, I as the deputy director, I have the sort of oversight of the policy area. That's my responsibility. So there's a capital markets branch that reports to me. They write the rules with their colleagues at the other agencies, and I'm sort of on top, oversight of that process, and I have extensive involvement in the Basel process since I came. So
I was looking for some on the ground kind of discussion about the residual rule, but there he is. Oh, he's coming back.
Sorry.
Good. Maybe,
Steve, are you going to transition into capital issues?
Well, we've kind of been through. The real estate guidance. We talked about how LTV, and you're exactly right. That's a guardrail. It's not a absolute limit. You start looking at the board. We've talked a little bit about the non-traditional mortgage guidance, and if you had any more information or discussion around Fremont, at the time, were examiners taking this guidance and sort of looking at what is the lending looking like here, or were they sort of looking at the risk layering, FICO score and LTV, and you may not. I'd be interested in any discussion around that. That seems to be, where like non-traditional products would be isolated, not in the Northeast.
I don't know. I wasn't on the exam. I can't give you the particulars. obviously, when they failed, we probably didn't look as closely as we should have. Okay,
that's a common.
I would say this: the whole California market out there, that's, you know, it's sort of unique. It's been that way for quite a while, and I can't give you, you might want to look at the exam reports or whatever you choose. I can't give you detailed information on that because I wasn't part of the exam.
Can I just ask you so I understand as a person who's least expert in this room? When a bank fails that is one of yours, what is the after-action report? I mean, what do you do to pounce on that situation and scrub through it?
Do you want to handle that one? Or?
Well, if it meets certain statutory requirements, we do material loss reviews by the Inspector General of the FDIC.
And where does that report go then? How widely is it shared?
Well, it's public and it's shared with Congress. It goes to Congress.
Okay. So each one of those is supposed to be its own warning, red light, alarm bell, right? If there's some lesson that can be drawn from it.
Yes, we do have a very independent and active Inspector General who not only does each report one at a time, also, sort of occasionally do a synthesis and go out and give a presentation at the regional offices or the field offices and, for here's some of the common themes we've observed in recent failures and lessons learned, and the Division of Supervision of the senior management, my boss Sandra Thompson takes those very seriously, and we we try to learn from those things. We have, I think, training now for examiners on trying to encourage a more proactive approach to supervision, and we do incorporate recommendations from the Inspector General reports on a regular basis.
Are there ever any repercussions to the individual examiners who were on the case at the time?
I don't believe so, and my belief, based on everything I've heard and seen, is that typically the examiners are seeing the problems and recommending that the bank, raising the concern appropriately. And then we have to decide as an agency, does it rise to a level of an enforcement action and, that sort of thing. And Steve, you may want to add in.
Yeah, well, one thing, with respect to Fremont about raising the thing, as far as I know, that was a one-off for us. If you look at all our bank failures in the last 2 years, almost all of them are related to construction financing. Yeah. That's and concentrations in commercial real estate, typically residential construction financing with a very heavy concentration in some of the areas that were the go-go growth areas that became the go-go bust areas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know, George. I can't think of any other bank. There was one in Ohio that was small that had some subprime mortgage stuff, but there was a lot of fraud there. It was very small. I think Fremont was pretty much a one-off.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you get in with the thrifts, that's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah. I'm just fishing. There are some canaries in the coal mine, and I know some of the FDIC staff were involved. This is in my district. So Keystone National Bank, I think it was 1999.
Right, yeah.
FDIC was in. It was mortgages. It was subprime mortgages and
securitization. Yeah, but that was a fraud failure, really.
Fraud.
It was a fraud failure. That I don't think was really a credit failure.
And any involvement in there or Superior, which came later, there was some FDIC involvement.
Well, the FDIC was very instrumental in
process.
Identifying and
yes.
aggressively pushing for corrective action in Superior and recognizing the losses and so forth. That was a, I think it had its genesis in an off-site FDIC expression of concern to the OTS and just keep pushing on that. And that was a, the residual, a lot of concentration in residuals, and that's my recollection of that.
As was Keystone.
Right.
To a large extent. But.
And we subsequently ended up deducting those dollar for dollar from regulatory capital as a policy matter.
Just another really simple question. Is there a simpleton question? Is there a good example of the FDIC working within a bank, an institution that was involved in something shaky and then was encouraged to do the right thing, to straighten up their activities? In other words, they were a success story.
The success stories.
Yes, we'd love to
hear. Can I? Well, everyone that doesn't fail and was part of a consent order is a success story, would be our view.
Well, I'm thinking in terms of, you were saying that very few of these are involved in subprime, so I was just wondering,
Let me put it this way. There are 829 banks on the problem bank list as of the end of the second quarter of 2010. That's a public number on the quarterly banking profile. Mm-hmm. There have been, 120 or so failures this year so far, or something like that. Last year there were 160. I always hear the statistic quoted that about, 10% of problem banks, or 5 to 10% ever fail. So it may be running a little higher than that right now. But all those others that don't fail, the regulators are all over those banks and pushing for more capital, stopping, the abusive or excessively risky practices. Whatever the problem is, the regulators are all over them. And so I would just say from sheer numbers, there are a lot of success stories.
And one other thing I think it's important to remember, there are banks that didn't necessarily do anything wrong that failed. They may have very good underwriting practices. They may have made a lot of good loans, but the economic downturn was so severe relative to them, and typically they were so concentrated in one type of product or asset or geographic concentration that they couldn't survive. Because the one thing regulators are not able to do is eliminate the risk that's inherent in lending, the economic risk of downturn. And that's what banks do. They borrow their money short and lend long for economic and consumer purposes. And for most community banks, it's not consumer. There's very little consumer lending in most of the banks that we do. It's almost all commercial.
In those cases, and I'm qualifying a little bit, but commercial real estate, as an example, there are guardrails, I guess, around that as a percent of capital. Kind of like, though, you say it's a guardrail, it's not a firm.
Yeah, it's
for commercial real estate.
Yeah, for commercial real estate, first of all, it's important to understand that commercial real estate, by our definition, is very, very broad.
That's right.
It's essentially any secured lending, any real estate secured lending that's non-farm and non-residential.
Right.
So if it's secured by real estate, it's going to be CRE. Half of what's CRE, roughly half, is owner-occupied, so it's actually an operating business that is securing its credit line with its real estate, probably with its other assets too, inventory, accounts receivable, equipment, personal guarantees, whatever. I would say this. One thing that clearly has been a factor is the residential construction, which was, residential construction got to, 20% of national output at the peak, which was, significantly over-normalized.
Yeah.
And in certain areas, it was huge, Las Vegas, parts of the Florida. We were looking at, condo lending in Florida in the early 90s, and the underwriting was really very conservative. I mean, people, because the decline was so sudden and so severe, a lot of those deals, those condo sales, you know, they had 25% deposits that people walked away from. I mean, that's almost unimaginable.
And this was in what time frame you were looking at?
Well, when the bust. I mean, okay. You know, after the bust, there were, when you looked at the underwriting on those condos, they were doing it very soundly. You know, when you get 25% to down payments, you wouldn't expect. You look, a lot of people walked away from those. That's how severe. Of course, you know, there was the investor market was so heavy into that, you know, the quote unquote. I don't even want to say the word. Since we're recording.
Well, before we went into capital crimes per se, I wanted to talk a little more about the banks where you're not the primary federal regulator.
Yeah.
In particular, because of some issues involving derivatives, one of the things that I wanted to ask you guys about were what you thought about the your status in bankruptcy vis-a-vis the qualified investment contracts that often have seniority over you, and the
when you say over us, you mean FDIC prior, and a failed prior. Bank?
The qualified investment contracts having priority in bankruptcy over the FDIC's claim on the banks, the estate, whatever the failed bank's assets to meet the depositors' needs.
I think, and you better talk, we can give you another name if you really want to pursue this, but I think the qualified investment QFC distinction basically tells us we have a certain amount of time to make a decision about the disposition of this claim, and that it doesn't say that it's a priority claim in bankruptcy.
But they get to do close, if they choose to close out, they close out prior.
Right.
So I assume if...
Well, that's not a superiority of claim, right?
If they get to close out before you guys get access to the assets, I would think that's...
But they don't. It's our decision.
It's your decision.
Yeah. We have to decide what to do with these things in a prompt manner. That's the nature of it. And we'd better get...
I think you need to talk to some other people or experts in that matter. That's not really so much a supervision problem as a resolution problem.
I
but I'm not sure that's right, your position is right.
I didn't come in here thinking I'm right about everything. I'm just trying to motivate the question that I was about to ask. And my concern is that if I'm right and that if your derivatives book gets closed out before the FDIC gets access to the assets, that makes... that closeout netting, not the net amount, but the part of the gross that gets netted down prior or senior.
Where they're holding the assets in safekeeping, where they have the ability to do that, to liquidate the collateral?
This is what I'm thinking in terms of qualified investment contracts, I'm thinking of basically repo and derivatives transactions. So you're in the money to them, $100 million, they owe you $90 million, now they owe you $10 million net. And that claim is senior, and so they can at least write down the $90 million before
as an offset.
Right. So instead of Lehman owing you $90 million, now they only owe you $10 million because the $90 million you owed them goes away. So that $90 million is very senior, and then also if you've got any collateral with them, you can have a first call on the collateral assets to meet your remaining $10 million net. And so in that sense, that two is prior. Or senior to, so I understand it, the FDIC's claim on those assets. So I mention this in part just to motivate a question, such as if that is the case, then shouldn't your examination look very carefully at your participation with other federal financial regulators to make sure that that particular aspect of risk is being carefully monitored, since it is prior. To your insurance function.
Yeah.
And so it's not like, I realize you can't, you know, you don't have the resources and you're not, don't have the same statutory status maybe as some of the other federal financial regulators regarding large banks. But on the other hand, you guys are really exposed there, mm-hmm. It seems to me. So I was just kind of wanting to ask what are you doing about that?
Well, anybody who has collateral, they get their collateral back, and they get
that's
it first.
That's not true. If you're over collateralized, you don't get it back.
Well,
first.
Okay.
You become an unsecured creditor for that collateral.
But your position is taken care of. If you're over collateralized, you get the part that's you were owed. So, and that's always been the case. I mean, it's not just a derivatives.
Yeah, that's typical commercial law in almost all states. You have the right of offset against assets, although you've got the bankruptcy provisions. And if you have possession of the collateral, you can do whatever you want, subject to the bankruptcy court preference action, or litigation. I mean, we litigate other claimants, and we didn't litigate with holding companies. We have litigation ongoing right now with some large holding companies about intercompany tax agreements, tax allocation agreements, and things like that. But I don't think you're correct about the preferential status. I don't think that's right, but I wouldn't be the expert. We'd have to get you to the right people there. I don't think that assumption is correct, that there's some legal preferential standpoint.
I maybe it's the way I'm trying to describe it as a non-bankruptcy attorney, but I do believe that if they choose, they can choose closeout netting, and they
per their contract terms.
For all the what they call qualified financial contracts, I think they're called something like this, and basically it includes everything under ISDA.
We need to get you to talk to an expert.
I mentioned it largely
but I
to motivate the question. If that's right, then you guys have exposure as a result of that. So I was just trying to set that up as a way of saying that. So if you've got exposure to these instruments. Now, if you don't have exposure to them, you could say, okay. Then we can just, there's why
we're. We have superpowers under Dench Doom to aggregate any contracts within a specified period of time. Are you aware of that?
No. What's that called? Not superpowers.
It's the Dench Doom doctrine, right? It was a court case 30 years ago. We have what's called superpowers to abrogate contracts within reasonable time frames after a failure.
The banks don't go wacko with that? I mean, if you got JP Morgan with $93 trillion of derivatives on your book and you've got someone in
there. Well, there are ways around that. If you control the collateral, then.
But those aren't all that well collateralized. So there's a lot of exposure in the $93 trillion that they're booked.
Well, most people don't think banks were going to fail, do they?
Right, but they went nuts about legal certainty prior to the 2000 Commodity Futures Modernization Act, and so I'm thinking, holy cow, if you compare it to what they thought was being threatened Brooks and Boren at the CFTC, that seems to me a much more serious threat than anything that the kind of rulemaking by the CFTC ever did. I'm just trying to think out loud here about the what might be some inconsistency in the market's anxiety about the legal certainty.
Go ahead, Steve.
I would say this. I think we and our sister regulators look at all financial contracts of size and the potential risk and obligation to the institutions. I think that's what we do. Do we always get it exactly right assessing that? Not always. But that's not something that we don't look at.
I do think that the general point is: do you guys understand the dangers to you of heavily reliance on secured funding arrangements? Yes, the FDIC is very aware that increases our resolution costs. We have an assessment regulation for risk-based deposit insurance that factors in the reliance on secured borrowing specifically. We have a large bank risk assessment program that includes the loss severity in the event of default as a specific evaluation factor in determining the premium that we're going to charge the institutions. That's run out of our division of insurance and research, by the way, not the division of supervision that I'm in. Mm-hmm. But it's there. And I am not the expert on this, but there is a rulemaking that the FDIC proposed in the spring of this year that dealt with the changes in as a result of FAS 166 and 167 in a situation where a bank has sold things, but it's now brought back on balance sheet as a result of the accounting change. What will the FDIC's position be in a failure situation? Will we try to reach out and take those assets back? And you talked about the industry going wacko.
Yep.
That would be an example of where they were very concerned by, they wanted certainty as quickly as possible about what the FDIC would do. Now, I don't actually know the status of that that regulation, but certainly it's a high-profile issue, and we have people who are very expert on, you know, the bankruptcy, the QFCs, and what happens, and what we can do with those contracts. And so, if you want to pursue that, I would recommend
helping with getting the clarification would be helpful too, because you know, it's something I've tried to figure out. And no, like I said, I'm not a bankruptcy attorney, and so there's some.
Yeah.
I'm trying to, you know, I try to articulate it as best I can, but apparently it's not yeah. perfect. But I do worry though that if I am correct, then that is particular exposure, because mm-hmm. you're then not kind of the taxpayers are not first in line. You know, at least you could say with your relationship with the Federal Housing Finance Banks, those are, you know. That's we were also prior, I think, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have. Yes, that's right. That has been an ongoing issue. Yes, because there are a lot of penalties built into those contracts,
mm-hmm.
and yes, they typically exercise those. But I don't know that anybody else has the ability to do that. That we can't pursue. Legally.
But one other might be the Federal Home Loan Banks.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And that is a lot of the secured funding that mm-hmm. ends up in a lot of banks.
But as a practical matter, you're having to rely a great deal on your relationship with other financial regulators who have more resources, and we put more resources into monitoring the large banks.
Yeah, well, they have, several dozen or more full-time resident examiners at some of the very largest institutions, so we have necessarily a different level of contact. We rely mostly on them, and we do have some on-site presence.
So you're, of course, what I'm told for some of the big dealer banks, they've got, you know, 20 to 30 people there, and you guys have one. And so that one FDIC representative must...
Well, I would also say this. You know, two of the three regulators are represented on our board of directors, the FDIC's board of directors, too. So it's not like they aren't invested in the FDIC's... insurance fund as an issue for their regulation, and yes, we are reliant where we're not on the other federal regulators, just as reliant on the states, because we have alternating programs of exam programs in most of the states where we trade off on exams, every other exam, where we don't do joints. So yes, we are reliant on our sister agencies.
Right. But with the smaller banks, they're probably not as complex.
No, yeah,
they're not only smaller, but they're not as complex.
Yeah, that's a fair statement.
And so they they're, you know, so many of those kind of transactions are conducted just by the largest dozen or so banks.
Right.
So that's why I was just curious how you guys would. I mean, it seems to me if you got one guy on the ground there, then that one guy's gal's got to, you know, kind of keep, you know, has a breadth of responsibility that's unparalleled by all the other folks there that are digging in on their subject area, and you've got one person that's got to worry about the, you know.
There's a memorandum of understanding that has just been agreed within the last 6-8 weeks, I think, with the other agencies regarding our presence. And I'm not, it's not my firsthand job responsibility to follow that, but basically I think it increases the number and the type of situations where we're involved. And so so it's not, it's no longer just one necessarily at all of these big banks.
So I see you can sort of fly somebody in, you could gather your repo specialist or something that you can drop in at will.
I'm not familiar with the details of the MOU, but it's a
And I would say even for the other agencies, most of their examiners are generalists too. So when they have to draw on a high level of, you know, very narrow subject matter expertise, they draw on their staff in Washington or in their regional office.
That's right. Some of them have teams that they that are not, aside from the guys that are resident.
Right. Firms, they send around.
We've got some teams. And in fact, that was also one of the interesting things we discovered, that those were the only people who had a common view of all the big banks were the guys that were on the circulating team, because everyone else was, you know, kind of down in the silo and just looked at that one bank, and it was only that the people who were in those teams had a horizontal kind of experience on that. So,
when you said that you knew what was going on in the marketplace, to what extent did you have disquiet about what was brewing at the banks you didn't supervise?
Let me say, I will have to play this back to see if I said I knew what was going on in the marketplace. I said, we read the papers, too, and we try to know what's going on in the marketplace.
You said we saw what was going on. It's the quote.
Yeah, okay.
So just tell me what you mean. When you saw what was going on, did you have a sense of that unease about
my,
what was
My point there yeah. in context was that the people wouldn't just necessarily know what was going on just there in the institutions mm-hmm. they were supervising. They read the papers. They knew that there were other issues, other products mm-hmm. that the banks they were supervising mm-hmm. weren't using that they were competing against. Mm-hmm. They also knew that the more exotic products were being trumpeted by the thrifts and the non-bank entities mm-hmm. primarily. So, you know, they have market awareness mm-hmm. other than just the right. institution that they're supervising at the time.
Right.
And I will say that I will freely admit that not everyone knew everything that was going on. I'll be, because I was one of them. I'll give you an example. I think it was late 2007. I had a briefing about the developments in the rated securitization, and it came out that somebody mentioned, oh, you know, the percentage of stated income loans in many of these securities were on the order of 80 to 90% as commonplace, and that they had, of course, they had originally been rated AAA, despite the fact that overwhelmingly the loans in them were stated income. Mm-hmm. So there's a fact. That's just a factoid, a random fact that I thought was incredible, and it, you know, it kind of to me suggested that the market had, the dynamics had really gotten away from itself, and maybe people who were really working every day in that market knew this and what understood it. I don't think that everybody in the chain in the regulatory agencies understood the extent to which all this was happening. I mean, I think it's a process of learning, and it takes, you know, in retrospect, everybody could have done a better job. Nobody's denying that. So,
It's interesting that you talked about it as a process of learning, because what you just described is a process of acceptance. That's a different thing, right? That you saw that they had accepted this.
Right. Right.
They accepted it.
Nobody. I don't. When I say who was they who accepted it, I mean the rating agencies who signed the rating
yes.
accepted it,
yeah.
and the people who bought the securities accepted it. So,
right. Well, I will just say this: the warning signs That suggests predicting the future. You know, predicting the future is an activity that's fraught with risk and uncertainty. And so we're not really, we try to be forward-looking as possible. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I'll give you a perfect example. At the height of the real estate boom, there were plenty of people out there that were saying, you know, the market was overvalued 10-15%. There were a lot of people. I read people that recognized that. Nobody was saying the market was overvalued by 50%. And let me tell you, the difference between those numbers, the economic impact of the difference of those numbers is huge.
Well, the reason I asked you is because for 34 years, you've seen a lot.
Yeah, I've seen a lot, but history has never exactly repeated itself.
But unfortunately,
yeah, I mean,
unheard of, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I have some personal views on it. I'm not going to share. And, you know, if we knew then what we knew now, boy, we could have done a lot of things differently. You know, there were a lot of people that wouldn't have bought houses, you know. My next door neighbor, for one.
Did you have any friends or relatives that you warned, you know, just kind of cautiously, who were getting a little crazy and exuberant?
No, I knew no one personally that speculated on. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, you know, residential real estate. I mean, I didn't know anybody that was flipping houses or doing anything like that. And the reality is, if somebody buys a house, I've moved around 7 times in the FDIC in 34 years, and I've lost money on houses. I've made money on houses, and I've never looked at it as an investment. An investment is something that generates income. Unfortunately, people started looking at houses and investments.
Right.
And, you know, I'm just speaking personally there. I really don't want that to go into the record here.
Well, we've heard that before. It's
oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But we've heard this many times before, and people have different theories about how we evolved into that.
I mean, you know, to me, the biggest warning sign is when the housing got to be 20% of GDP. That's when it's double the normalized number, then it's probably not going to stay that, right?
That's right. I guess one thing, George, you made this comment about, this was, you know, kind of, you know, a factoid that, I mean, I had similar ones, but in terms of an agency and the process that you talked about in terms of, you know, this national group sort of, mm-hmm. this was a part of that discussion, I'm assuming, one of the presentations? Or
this particular one was not, but we did discuss this issue as an agency in the National Risk Committee, and we put out guidance to our institutions on the dangers of, you know, buying securities without adequate due diligence. Specifically, we had some concerns about a big group of community banks that had ratcheted up their holdings even after the crisis began. I mean, and they were very aggressive marketing to them. And
so this would have been a regular. I mean, as you hear this, that 90% are stated income, you would know from an underwriting standpoint, well, that's not our institutions, but we may have some concerns.
The holders, absolutely.
What was the setting for this late 2007 eureka moment?
Just people in my office telling me, you know, we're going over what do we know about these securities, and turned out we had access in the Bloomberg to bunch of interesting statistics, one of which was the percentage of stated income. It has no significance other than the fact that it was a moment that I remember as an example of, hey, it's, you know, probably I should have been focused on this before, you know.
Something. Well, it's also interesting because the information was there for basic research. It was there.
Well, if you subscribe to the Bloomberg and you know how to use it, I don't know how many people have the combination of a full-fledged Bloomberg subscription and the skills.
We're working on more.
And also are coming at it from a disinterested public policy perspective instead of making money. So it's a combination of factors that helps you to get the information, and not as easy as it should be to get that information.
Well, Steve, you needed to get into your...
We hadn't talked about capital so much. I think, you know, we talked about some of these other areas, but towards kind of capital is a focus of bank regulation and, you know, certain stopgaps towards doing activities. But there, you mentioned the residual recourse rule, and you know, it was designed to do a lot of things, but... You weren't involved with that one.
No.
So I won't.
And you're just going to discuss capital from here on in? Is that a fair statement?
We won't talk about you.
I never saw someone jump out of the chair so quickly.
All right. Nice to meet you. So we've got a limited time left. Kind of the framework for talking to other folks is, you know, kind of what was the program that you have for assessing capital adequacy? And then, you know, there were a couple of key pieces that proved to really be, you know, maybe challenge examiners. One was the recourse rule. What were you doing there in terms of originate to distribute? Firms involved with that type of balance sheet management, you know, they maybe got stuck. So your involvement as sort of a capital policy person, maybe start with just, you know, the exam program and challenges there.
Okay. I mean, first of all, I'll just tell you what I have been focused on.
That's fair.
A lot of my time has been focused on, I would say, a policy level view of the Basel process. From the very beginning in 2002, I and the FDIC had great concerns about the development of the advanced approaches for capital adequacy, which were developed in Basel. And it basically was a model-driven exercise where the large banks would set their own capital requirements by using their own internal risk inputs for probability of default, loss given default, and exposure for every loan and exposure they had. So we were very concerned about it because it appeared that it was going to be a significant reduction in capital requirements just basically at the stroke of a pen, you know, with no change in the bank's risk, just use a different approach and get a much lower risk-weighted asset number. And that concerned us, and we were very obstreperous and difficult, made a lot of difficulties for everybody. And in retrospect, I'm very proud that we did. And we've slowed down the process, there's no doubt about it. We insisted on additional safeguards within the U.S. process, a slower transition, more gradual transitional, what used to be called, or still called, transitional floors, which mm-hmm. said how much you can reduce your capital requirements compared to the general rules before the floor comes off. And the floor coming off literally means there is no floor on risk-based capital. It's whatever your internal model spits out. So we said before that ever happened, there would have to be an interagency study, and the agencies would have to affirm that there was no material deficiencies that cannot be corrected, you know, and we would correct it. So that was the nutshell of that whole episode, and that took from about 2002 to 2007 when the agencies issued the rule, the final rule on the advanced approach.
And that time frame is longer than the normal time frame for issuing guidance or rule.
The Basel Committee didn't even publish the document until 2004. It took them 5 years from 1999 to 2004. They went through four different versions of the paper. The very first one, interestingly enough, said, we have no intention of reducing capital requirements. You know, it was just a modest experiment, and we recognize all the competitive issues and so forth. By the time they got to 2004, the floor, you know, no floors. This is, you have to have the incentive to do this, so we recognize that, so we're going to give you a break. So it had sort of basically been, the process had changed direction, let's say that, over the 5 years. And then in the U.S., once the thing was published in 2004, we started the process of national implementation, which involved a quantitative impact study in the U.S. and extensive discussion of the results, which were very troubling in terms of the degree of reductions, 31 or 32% reduction in Tier 1 capital requirements as a median. And so, in any event, we finally got through that. We published the rule in 2007, and we had a very gradual transition process. Then we had the banking crisis, literally almost a few weeks after we published a press release in July of 2007 saying that we finally reached an agreement. Here's how it's going to work. About 2 weeks later, we started getting wind of the fact that, hey, there's a real problem out there in the financial markets that was much worse than anybody thought in about August of 2007. So the banking crisis came, liquidity crisis, and that kind of put the process of implementing the advanced approach a little bit slower. The banks had other things to worry about than developing their advanced approach systems. So now we're still in the process. There's a bank on parallel, so-called parallel run, number about to enter parallel run, and that's kind of where we are now.
Right. And, that, and that's true for all of the U.S. banks. We've talked to foreign regulators that, you know, were in Basel II. But there were elements of Basel II that were already in. We'd already adopted. One is the was the market risk amendment in 1996, which sort of morphed and evolved. The MRA framework would be used following a 1997 interagency for credit derivatives. What was the FDIC's involvement? And this is before you in 2002, but it, you know, it would be the framework 2002 and beyond in analyzing, you know, trading activities and likely the framework if you're doing a lot of credit derivatives. Was the FDIC involved?
Well, there were no changes in the market risk rule until the Basel Committee published in last summer. Some new requirements, which actually have not yet been implemented anywhere. But there literally was no change since almost since 1996.
But others have commented. I can go back to like a 2007 speech by Susan Bias that said, you know, folks are trading all sorts of things now that were never envisioned in 1996.
Oh, absolutely. No, there was the whole, in the the continuous Basel subcommittees, working groups, where we all talked about, the trading book is being misused. They're, you know, putting illiquid exposures in there and using their models to say that there's very little risk. So the VAR is a measure of price change, you know, over a 10-day period or whatever. And if your and if the price is determined by your model, Lo and behold, you won't show any variation in the price, so you don't have any capital for that. And I think the crisis really revealed how, I mean, the bulk of the losses, I think, for a lot of these banks were in the trading book. You know, so.
Well, they may have been assuming they could, you know, either sell or enter into a hedge within a day or two. And that's going to limit your 10-day losses if you only have to have the position open for a day or two. And it turns out they couldn't do that.
Yeah, it assumes the whole rationale for the trading book is that the reason you don't need much capital is that you can sell things quickly and just exit the position. And it turned out, not if they're illiquid.
Yep, that trading book you can't trade.
Yeah.
One commenter pointed to the specific risk charge at that and pointed out that for mortgage portfolios that had basically a 50% risk-based charge, that suddenly that specific risk charge is essentially 100% with a VAR kicker. You're
That doesn't make any sense.
But let's go.
I mean, if you're looking at a 50% charge in the banking book for your mortgage,
50% of 8% is kind of the
50% risk weight.
That's right.
4% capital requirement. If it goes into the trading book, I mean, I don't know what the numerical charge is going to be. It's going to be very low, you know, far, far lower than what it would have been in the banking book.
It's just a price volatility charge.
Mm-hmm. The magic of the trading book, in my mind, and it's not good magic, is that when you ask a question like, well, if a mortgage would be 4% in the banking book, 50% risk rate, what would it be in the trading book? No one can answer that question for you because there is no single answer. It is, well, it's whatever the bank, whatever their models say it is. So it depends on, you know, how it interacts with all the other charges in the portfolio, so all you know at the end of the day is they have, you know, X billion in trading assets and the charge is Y. That's it.
Since it's a market value-based capital charge, it would depend on how the mortgage fits into the variance of their portfolio. So it could almost lower the capital charge because it could possibly reduce existing risk.
So, you know, as we wrote guidance about this stuff, in the market risk amendment, there's strong language about the importance of risk management, of examiner understanding, and the diligent review of these models, including correlation assumptions, and ensuring that there's stresses beyond just the historical or variance covariance models or Monte Carlo, whatever she used. What was your two things? What is your view? Because you obviously were involved in this, but two. How is the FDIC sucked into this? I mean, is Robert Burns having to look at variance models? Is he looking with the OCC or the Fed, SEC? Because you were aware that things were askew.
The primary people on the ground looking at these market risk models, looking at the big picture, it's mostly the OCC and the Fed examiners who are doing it. The FDIC has just some good market risk examiners. I would say that looking from the top down and in retrospect, that all those things about risk management and, the importance of fully and comprehensively modeling all of the intricate risks and, it wasn't effective. It was not effective. In retrospect, there were huge losses. They were not captured in the risk models or identified, by the supervisory process. I think, and this is my personal opinion, that the time between 1996 and 2007, when the banking crisis hit, was basically the age of regulatory deference to the banking industry. That's just my personal view, and that virtually every regulatory capital change during that time, including the recognition of trust preferred securities as Tier 1 capital, the recourse rule, changes in the capital treatment of repos, everything, and Basel II being the prime example, the advanced approach, was in the direction of lowering capital requirements. So I think that there was probably excessive faith in the risk management and measurement abilities of the banks. I think we were collectively wowed by them. I mean, I've sat in presentations from, you know, big banks, PowerPoint shows about their process for modeling risk and measuring it, and it's really honestly very impressive. Very good presentations, and I'm sure they really believed it.
Right.
So I think that was what was going on, that we just, over time, we just got too caught up in the new technologies for measuring risk and for modeling risk, and it just, part of it was the rating agencies, that they were, you know, fully involved in assigning lots of good ratings using some of these same approaches that the banks were using. So I think we kind of let things get a little out of control during that time.
Why do you start it in 96?
I started then because of the market risk rule, which is one of the examples of, we're going to do an important safety and soundness initiative. For the first time, we will have capital requirements for market risk. So it sounds like we're doing something that is stringent. In fact, what we're doing is allowing them to take out a big section of their exposures and have lower capital for them.
So that's what they created the trading book, essentially.
Yeah.
Adequacy category.
Yeah. Now, I fully admit I'm kind of a bit idiosyncratic in my view, so, but this is my perception of the time, was that it was a bit of an industry dominant.
I didn't know why you didn't go back further. I suppose the interbank rule didn't seem like it was quite the same change in of risk management.
The interbank rule?
We allowed interstate banking, sorry. What was it, 94? Was the interstate banking deregulation?
I must admit you stumped me there. I kind of think of PCA, prompt corrective action, right. The early 90s, we started implementing that, and that was a tightening in the U.S. We had the leverage requirement.
That came out of Korea or?
Fiduciary. So I kind of think of the industry got a new set of requirements in the early 90s, and somehow by the time the mid 90s came, they had regrouped from a policy perspective and were ready to, you know, push back, and were successful.
Of course, driven in an international way, you know, through the BIS.
I think there's probably recognition now generally that we went a little too far with reductions in capital requirements back then. That's part of why Basel III has come, you know, why we're doing the things we're doing now.
Can I toss one up for you? The leverage ratio, the FDIC's involvement, and sort of your view.
We're involved in all aspects of the Basel process, and there's many, many working groups, and one of which is on the leverage ratio.
Yes.
And we like the fact that it does now include some off-balance sheet risks, which there's two ways of looking at that. One is that the simple on-balance sheet risk measure that we have in the U.S. has the virtue of simplicity, and it doesn't pretend to be a risk-based framework, and so it's very easy to use. Bringing in the off-balance sheet is conceptually, it has a great deal of merit, because there are things that you miss when you're just doing the on-balance sheet. And in fact, that we didn't capture adequately with the with the risk-based framework. So by having a very simple approach with a leverage ratio for off-balance sheet risks, that's kind of the equivalent of a leverage for on-balance sheet.
Can I ask you kind of devil's advocate a little bit? With the traditional leverage ratio, certain transactions were on balance sheet, not for risk-based capital perhaps, but you know they were on the balance sheets. They weren't transferred like credit default swaps. Others like, for instance, asset-backed commercial paper programs or securitizations were off balance sheet in terms of the leverage ratio. Do you have a comment around, I mean, but some of the activities were. So in terms of, well, I don't even know where the question is on this one. I'm just looking for your historical perspective really on this.
I mean, we had, one of the reasons why Basel I came in was because people recognized that off-balance sheet risks were more important, were becoming more important. And so Basel I actually has a lot of, you know, capital requirements for off-balance sheet risks. And, in fact, Basel II, ironically, although it, a lot of sound and fury about greater risk capture, greatly reduced the capital requirements for off-balance sheet risk. But to address the leverage ratio...
And the derivatives is, I think, the question. Ostensibly were covered in the leverage ratio.
The theory of an on-balance sheet leverage is that the off-balance sheet risks should be captured by the risk-based framework. That's the theory, and that the on-balance sheet leverage will give you a basic baseline of capital that is there, and you can't game it. Okay. Expanding that to include off-balance sheet risks, again, is conceptual merit, and it was very controversial in Basel about how we did it. Within the committee, there were different ways to do it, and we ended up agreeing on one way to do it, and the 3% leverage requirement, which is less than the 5 we have in the U.S., but it's a bigger denominator. So some banks will have... higher capital requirements under a 3% leverage ratio than they would under the U.S. version, a 5% ratio, unless they start restructuring their activities.
Can I ask about, go back to some historical context, and again, I'm not, you know, mortgages other than Fremont, not particularly an FDIC issue in terms of origination. Asset-backed commercial paper programs, CIVs, all of these sort of securitization-like or securitization tools, and then our bank's involvement with securitization activities directly in selling into these. What was the FDIC's involvement? What part of the crisis was this for the FDIC banks? And
I mean, you talk about FDIC banks. Well, if you're talking about FDIC supervised banks, I don't think it's much. You know, we're the like Steve said, commercial lending. A lot of it secured by commercial real estate.
Right.
That's what we have had to focus on as supervisors. But the big picture, the FDIC as insurer and resolution authority. There was a lot that we had to focus on in the fall of 2008, and that caused us. Some of these issues that you mention are reasons why the FDIC had to establish the temporary liquidity guarantee program in the fall of 2008, which had the unprecedented step of providing assistance to bank holding companies. So those kinds of issues confronted us as an agency in the fall of 2008.
And then you mentioned on the investment side, CDO TRUPS, some of these. What other sort of structures beyond, I mean, were the FDIC banks, other than the CDO TRUPS, impacted by CDO structures, or was it primarily private label RMBS, jumbos, you know, that kind of ABCP? Or
I think for our community banks, it was mostly the CDO, TRUPS, the private label, mortgage-backed securities, were the ones that have caused them the most trouble. And that's been enough. I think some of those CDO TRUPS have, you know, the rating agencies have put out opinions saying that investors should basically view the recovery on any of these as zero. particularly if you're talking about the mezzanine tranches or worse.
Are there any innovative of the FDIC portfolio managers that are taking these TRUPS apart or taking apart the private labels? And, you know, the FASB changed the way OTTI was. Are they kind of zeroing in on a good OTTI number? Are they able to sort of do cash flow analysis on this? Or,
you know, we have a group of capital market specialists in the FDIC. And
I think we'll talk to them in a separate meeting.
Good. I mean, we have the capital markets branch, and we have the support for the exam process, and then each region has a capital markets specialist, so they provide support to the examiners when they need to do valuation of a security. And I think they provide good support, although I'm not an expert by any means. If you're talking about the FDIC, is what we do with these things when we get them in a failed bank, you should talk to the Division of Resolution and Receiverships. And actually, I think we're, you know, doing what we can. Yeah, whatever works, we'll do it.
We'll make a deal.
The ones that got them in trouble, is it did it cut across all vintages, or was it mostly the guys that got in late?
I don't know the answer to that. That's a good question.
With CDO traps?
Well, or the broader range of sort of subprime-related structured mortgage products that lost so much of the value if it was...
I've heard, and I hate to say this with a tape recorder running, so it's really to the best of my recollection that it was securities issued in 2006, early 2007, before the crisis really hit, and maybe late 2000, maybe some in 2005, but that was the worst of the worst. This is my recollection.
So that's typical. I think that's typical. Those are the ones that have the most problems. And so if they got in late and were more heavily concentrated in that vintage, then that would that would aggravate the problem than those people who had gotten in 3 or 4 years before that.
One last question. Is there anything that you would want to make sure that the FCIC looked at to give the full spectrum dimensions of this to the public that you would just worry that we haven't looked at or that we should look at further or someone we should talk to? Or
well, I think the no offense. I think the trust preferred securities were a big deal. When we look at the distribution of capital for banks and bank holding companies, as we've had to do, sort of to try to get a sense of capital raising needed under various Basel III type scenarios. What if we did this requirement? What if we did that requirement? And we look at insured banks. And we come away with a good feeling that, you know, hey, they're pretty strong. But then if you add their bank holding companies on top of them and look at the consolidated entities, the picture looks much different and much weaker, the bank holding companies have taken full advantage of, you know, pushing to the extent they're permitted to take advantage of the Tier 1 treatment of trust preferred. And it really does show in their financial strength as a consolidated organization, and it hurt them in the crisis. I mean, it cost us a lot of money. A lot of the times when we're trying to get again, I'm not a resolution specialist, but my understanding is it complicates the scenario in a failing bank situation to try to find a rescuer, somebody to inject capital, but you can't get the holders of the trust preferreds to agree to convert to a common because they have a cumulative dividend, and there's no reason for them to compromise. And
they have a 5-year deferral feature, and you know the thought at the time.
Yeah, I understand.
1997, the thought was 5 years is a long time, and so the the dividend holder, the trust preferred holders, feel assured enough in their position. I mean, otherwise they walk away with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
They have a strong enough bargaining position to try to force this.
Yeah.
Wow.
When you say it costs us a lot of money, is there a dollar figure?
I don't think that there is a dollar figure. I think one of the documents that we gave you was a letter from Sheila Bair to Susan Collins, but it doesn't have a dollar figure in it.
And it's costing you money for the banks that held the trust.
It's the ones that held it, and we have to dispose of it, and then also the difficulty that it causes in bringing new capital into banks that have a lot of trust preferreds in their financing structure.
One other thing, we barely touched on ratings agencies. Is there anything you want to add on that front that would be helpful or valuable, you think?
I don't think that I can add to what people all over the policy community have already said. I do think that there probably was some conflict of interest, implicit real-world pressure to give a good rating to keep the business going, and that somehow that the development of these metrics and models that the rating agencies were using fed on the bank's development of the models and the rating agencies' development of the models kind of fed on each other, because often the banks would say, you know, in to support their own models, hey, we use the same models that the rating agencies are using.
And Basel went with that framework for securitization for like an internal assessment approach.
Yeah. So I do think it contributed to the problems, and that the fact that suddenly people lost confidence in the ratings at some point in late 2007 or, you know, early 2008, and just walking away, you know, basically I can't rely on this anymore, is just a huge systemic hit to liquidity and confidence that just of tremendous importance. So the fact that we were increasing reliant on it and then go cold turkey, we can't depend on it anymore, it's just a terrible thing.
Could you explain why it makes it hard to track the firm had issued trust preferred shares? Given that you've gone through resolution, you could hypothetically just wipe them out.
Now, we're talking about an open bank. If we want to avoid a closing.
A non-resolution P&A of some sort.
Yeah. Again, we could get you to, if you want to talk to somebody in resolution, we could do that. But this is for a challenge of dealing with an open bank solution that doesn't involve FDIC assistance.
And so all that would be honored. So they're coming in as the common equity and having to deal with dividends.
And I would note, just for your to close your story, if you're telling this story or whatever, the trust preferred part of it and the advanced approach part of it is, if one way to think of it is the final chapter of the story is the Section 171 of the Dodd-Frank, which is the Collins Amendment, which basically says that the insured bank general capital requirements are a floor for those of bank holding companies. So implicitly, since we don't allow TRUPS at the bank level, that would basically say going forward they're not going to be allowed at the holding company level because of Section 171. There's some grandfather, and there's also the advanced approach part of it is that the IDI requirements, the general requirements, are a floor for any requirement we make. Okay. So that would mean that the advanced banks would face a floor on their requirements. So the whole idea of, you know, you can go below and you can go more below and more below, and that's all gone away.
Essentially, the TPS and the holding company structure is eliminated because you've got to go to the bank level. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's
right.
You know, in 97, you squeeze one place and you get another. The concern was REITs. And those were the structures that were being developed, and the trust preferred were allowed as a as an alternative structure, kind of a. So it's interesting that they, I mean, they were financial innovation. First Tennessee was securitizing these things and putting them in CDOs. Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
So these are very interesting comments.
Okay.
Yep. Good.
All right. Sure thing.
Okay. We're turning this off.
Thank you.
Yes, everybody. Yes.